After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu. I'm back with Mind Rolling and just talking to my guest today, Amanda Gilbert. Amanda, so great. I said, Amanda, you look familiar, like we already know each other. Not that we can find any kind of place where we might have happened to meet up, but it's just that the vibration, right?
Truly, it's so good to be here. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on your beautiful show, Raghu. I'm delighted.
So, Amanda has a wonderful book, by the way, called Kindness Now. And right on the top there, Tara Brach, who's, that's a good testimonial. Let this wise and beautiful book guide you on this path of healing and freedom. For me, freedom is the byword. For sure. But just looking around, see what it is that I could find that would prompt me to certain avenues of getting to know you better. And on your website, so one of the things that I usually do is say to a guest that I don't know or have not met, maybe more accurate, just how did the evolvement of you from as a child into an adult include finally at some point, which is what happened to me, I realized there was a path that we did not have to be in, for me at the time, in this depressive miasma. And, only Bob Dylan was my savior in that moment because he made it known that we are all in this boat. So it's okay. So it was the first time I kind of knew it was okay until I happened to meet up with John Coltrane, not meet him, but be in his presence when he was performing when I was really young. And had a whole other experience. But that's another story. But the reality is, I look at your... So I was looking at your... at the website, just about you. And it says, Amanda first meditated at the age of 17 while being homeschooled in West Virginia with a group of Native American, African, and South American Native elders. Okay. This is not my experience and not the experience of most people. I mean, how did they get there? Who are your parents? What are we talking about?
I love that we're landing right here. And just to even take a step back too, I love that you brought in the aspect of path. Like, when do we really realize that there is a path through our human lives, our human existence, in the sense where we can maybe learn how to meet our human lives with an open heart as much as we can, especially as modern human beings. And I find that there is such a sense of familiarity when we meet each other on the path. And I sense that sense of home and familiarity here with you too. And for me, I first stepped onto the path in that moment that you described, and I actually also talk about it in one of the opening chapters in Kindness Now, my recent book, because it is a unique story, that was a very particular circumstance to find myself in as a teenager. And what got me there was actually the experience of real dissatisfaction. I had become a really classic angsty teenager, completely disenchanted by pretty much everything other than a few moments of art class, was acting out unskillfully in a variety of ways, from not going to school to staying out late past curfews. I mean, that whole perfect picture of adolescent angst. And so my parents had the wonderful opportunity to figure out what to do with me, number one, and number two, how to just help me get through high school in a efficient way, I guess, at that point. My mom actually was heavily involved with the Landmark Education Forum, which is a personal growth and development organization that focuses a lot on personal growth techniques and personal empowerment techniques. And so in a sense, we had a very open dialogue about learning lessons together as a family. We had open lines of communication. So we all sort of realized at one point, okay, let's just get Amanda through the rest of her obligatory schooling as quickly as possible. So they, very lucky for me, found a homeschool in the middle of the Appalachian Mountains in West Virginia. And the founder of the school no longer exists. It closed down a number of years ago. But the founder of this school had spent decades down in South America learning the indigenous wisdom of the four winds from elders in South America. And the wisdom of the four winds is very much along the lines of each of the four winds, north, south, east, and west, symbolizes and embodies wisdom, different aspects of ancient wisdom in that particular culture. The north represents finding your true authenticity and North Star, and the wind of the east is the wind of change. And so this was all instilled into the curriculum at this high school. And there were Native American elders who had come to teach us young people at this school. There was a prince, there was royalty from Africa there at this school. It was just an incredible gathering of people, of humans. And I can see that now, especially at the age and the location where I'm at now, just like how beautiful these humans were who all showed up to do this work with us at that age. And so my first time meditating was in the mornings at this school with my hiking boots all laced up, because we were doing a lot of wilderness-based skill sets and techniques, and we were working a lot with nature at that time. And we'd lace up our hiking boots and we'd all gather around in a circle, and we were told to bring our attention inwards and really start to contemplate like what our North Star of the day was, what our intentions were, what type of people we wanted to be in the world. And it was the first time that I ever meditated. It was the first time I also ever felt a sense of home and safety and ease and belonging inside of myself. And so it was that very first moment meditating in high school in the middle of the woods in the Appalachian Mountains where I got that real taste of what I'd really been searching for unskillfully all of those years prior.
Really? Good karmas. I mean, I was very similar to you, and I got sent away, but I was bad. You're good. I was actually acting out way beyond, like taking my father's hot sports car and racing in the streets after midnight, you know, and all of that. And oh my God, that I survived is a miracle. So they sent me away to a school, private school, Cheshire Academy, actually, in Connecticut, right near Yale, New Haven. And just I continued to act out. I got saved by a teacher who cared about me. Isn't that what it's all about? in terms of students and teachers, where you feel like you're cared for and you respond to that, which I did and barely just got out of all of that. But you, on the other hand, were handed these incredible elders and a dimension of authenticity that is very rare, very rare. Not that I should complain. I went to India, you know, this is all about 15, 16 and all that. And I look back now, I went, oh my, like 7 or 8 years later, I ended up in India, you know, with Ram Dass and Neem Karoli Baba. So I very good. It was very good, you know, so I have nothing to complain about. But I do remember the suffering and those days and stuff like that happens in all of our growing up, what we take on, what we are handed, causes and conditions, the kind of parents that we had, elicit a certain something that is up there for transformation, grist for the mill, as Ram Dass used to call it. So, and that took quite a while to even realize that. And I did what many people did when they found the path, a lot of bypassing, a lot of spiritual bypassing, which is so endemic and common with all of our brethren that are in all these different traditions and so on. But so then what, after you got out of that school, what happened?
It was really interesting because even though I had meditated at that point and it really touched my mind and my heart at that age. I noticed for the years after that meditation kept showing up at my doorstep, almost unsolicited and unasked for, whether it was by being a part of my undergraduate college curriculum or by certain notable people literally handing me books on meditation that were timely medicine that I needed at that point in time, and really just having a lot of really incredible meditation teachers and spiritual teachers just in my sphere or in my world. I spent about 3 to 4 years living in Prescott, Arizona, where I went to college after high school, and being in Sedona, being in that part of the world, there was an aspect of spirituality there, just sort of in my communities and my college, even in the landscape. And so looking back now, I can really see that meditation kept showing up. It kept coming to me in all these variety of ways. And then though, what got me really serious about meditation, because before I'd always remembered that first initial moment in high school and just how much it had really supported my inner world when I was meditating at that point. I definitely was more of a crisis meditator, you know, when things when things weren't going well, or I had the big test the next day, or my life was falling apart in that moment, you know, whatever was going on in college, I would meditate then, and it was so helpful, and I felt better, and crisis. Then a few days later, a few days later, I wouldn't be meditating anymore. And then I encountered just a really big life-altering moment in my early 20s where, you know, just all sense of identity was lost. The rug was pulled out from underneath me. Life as I knew it changed dramatically and immediately changed. And so I was then in a period of healing, yes, but also trying to put the broken pieces back together again after what I'd been through, and talk about just maybe the karma or this aspect of our true north or our authenticity kicking in, our inner wisdom kicking in. Something during those first few months of my healing process said to me, without a shadow of a doubt, it said, Amanda, meditation is going to be the way that you eventually perhaps put yourself back together again. Meditation is the way that you will perhaps heal and maybe become whole or complete or you again. And in that moment, that's when I got really serious about meditation, and I went and found my first teachers. I started to sit meditation retreats. I started a daily meditation practice in 2009, and that was a big shift for me that really spawned the next chapter of like my meditation path, which was that I became a consistent and daily meditator. And then luckily also was in clinical research at one point too, where I was studying the clinical effects of mindfulness and meditation at UCSF.
Yeah, I saw that. That's fascinating work as well. And you came up with what the close to or knew about, of course, what the Tibetans were doing, or the Richie Davidsons of this world were experimenting with the Tibetan lamas and so on, starting with Mingdjo Rinpoche, actually.
Yes. I love that body of research so much.
Yeah, it is so fantastic. Do you know, have you met Mingdjo Rinpoche?
I haven't met him. No, I haven't met him yet.
Do you know who he is?
He's
Right. Tukul Urgin's sons. I mean, they're all great. It's like the most... I've done actually a couple of podcasts with him. There's something... I mean, just his face with that shining reflection of loving awareness, Ramdas. He's really a reflection of that. He's incredible and so real. And he was, they worked with him the first time using all of that science around just trying to calculate what happened on these monitors when they would say, and in this case, they said to him, okay, so get into compassion, however they said that to him. And they said, usually, you know, regular people have been meditating forever. You know, it takes a while. You sit and get centered and one pointed and then be able to go deeper and so on. Not him. They said compassion. Boom. He was there. Everything just started reading, however they designed that, reading exactly that kind of emotion. He's incredible. And he had terrible anxiety when he was young. And his father was the greatest, I mean, His Holiness's meditation teacher, I believe, Tulku Urgin, but one of the great, great practitioners of the last, whatever, 150 years or something. And he had this. Isn't it interesting? I'm just thinking out loud now, but that somebody comes in to this great lama's family, both, you know, Chokyi Nyima and Tsokni Rinpoche, those are his brothers. I mean, each one an extraordinary being, and he's in the family, and he comes in with anxiety attacks, which drove him to transform, basically. I mean, this wasn't, I'm in this family, I should do something like meditate. This was, I have to. So, yeah, everybody look up Mingdjo Rinpoche, and you can find him on the Mind Rolling podcast, too. You would love it, Amanda.
I can't wait to listen to those episodes.
And actually,
bookmarked.
We record, as you know, because we're doing it right now, both audio and video. So he was in Kathmandu both times, and it was perfect connection. And so the videos lie at Be Here Now Network YouTube. So you got to see him, is what I'm saying. He is just seeing him, even if you never heard a word, you would like, oh, God, I get it. It's that powerful.
Isn't that aspect of the field so beautiful as far as, being in practitioner's presence like his? And I remember early on in my meditation path, actually, over the years I was helping support clinical research and this wonderful body of research on mindfulness and meditation at UCSF. Mm-hmm. I was going to a few conferences in San Francisco where there were Buddhist monks there at the conferences, and they were there doing an installation of mandala art, where they were building their mandalas in the middle of the conference rooms and conference floors out of, I believe, sand.
Different dyed sand. And they have the colored, different colors of it. Sand.
Right. Yeah. Right. And so over the course of the days, they would just take hours and hours and hours to build these elaborate, detailed, gorgeous mandalas. And one of my main first takeaways from being in their presence was that they seem to just really emanate a field of kindness and presence, one like I had never really been exposed to before, because these were some of the first true monastics I had come into contact with, because I had been in a lot of Western meditation centers up until that point, at least, or hadn't been in contact with a lot of true monastics. And I remember in that moment just thinking, wow, I'm literally seeing their field of kindness and compassion and open-heartedness and presence transform the people that they're in conversation with right now or in dialogue with or that are just standing a few feet away from them. And I actually wrote about this in Kindness Now from the aspect of there's a certain chapter called Widening the Circle of Joy. And it talks about when I was at a conference, another research conference in Boston, Massachusetts, with Richie Davidson, with Dr. Amishi Jha, and all these amazing neuroscientists. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama was a keynote speaker with Richie and Dr. Amishi Jha. And I remember that morning on the day of His Holiness's address, his keynote address, I remember walking out into the hotel lobby where the conference was being held, and he had arrived to the location that morning. There were FBI agents outside. There was media and news cameras. There were practicing Buddhist monks from that had gathered there from all over the northeast coast of the United States to see His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And I walked downstairs and just felt like the energy had shifted in the halls and the spaces and the conference rooms that we were all gathering in. And everybody was really present that morning, or it made me realize that it just one person's practice really does have the capacity to ripple out and can, in some ways, be felt for miles around us, that sort of joy and loving awareness and presence.
Yeah.
So I love that you brought that in.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely true. I mean, when I went to India as a young man, I got that right away, being around this incredible being and the way in which the effect was so powerful to each individual, exactly what it was they needed. If you can imagine a being doing, I mean, of course, this is no doing. And that's something we just rationally cannot comprehend. I mean, people say, well, he did all these miracles as if he was planning them or something. There was no doing, you know, there's no doing. And that's, of course, what we aspire to. And seeing in these humans, like, I mean, His Holiness, what does he say? He says, I am like I am. I have, you know, you think of me as a companion. He doesn't say it in these words, but I am like I am because of my mother. And that's what's going to be the savior of us in the future of humanity, is getting total loving, compassionate care from one's mother and growing. He said, that's what happened. That's who I am, why I am. My mother was that. And then you start, you know, how many, maybe, I mean, your mother was that nurturing? And I'm asking, was she?
My mother, when I was young, she was somebody I really, really looked up to. She was nurturing. She was really courageous and brave. And she was the type of woman who was just such a go-getter. Nothing really, really knocked her off her own path or really sparked a lot of fear within her. I remember noticing she was very empowered, very brave, and also just so kind. And it's interesting that we're talking about family in a sense in our causes and conditions, because one of the ways I actually have gotten to know the feeling of loving kindness in my own mind, body, heart field has been through the palpable and tangible transmission of loving kindness from my grandfather, my mother's father, and also from her, from my mother herself. They both embody such open-hearted generosity and kindness and just love and compassion that later on, as a person who had spent, you know, quite a bit of time meditating and studying meditation at this point and was learning so much about the heart practices and starting to practice with loving kindness and compassion and appreciative joy and equanimity techniques and practices, I realized after going home for like the holidays one year, I said, you know, when I'm in my grandfather's presence, I'm in a circle of loving kindness or metta right now. I feel connected to loving kindness or metta meditation, that metta presence, that loving, compassionate, generous heart. When I'm just with him and I'm hearing him laugh and make everybody else laugh around him. And my mother has that same quality within her as well. Do you have anybody in maybe in your family that embodies a similar quality of loving kindness or metta? I mean, it sounds like your teachers definitely hold an aspect of that.
Well, Sharon's my teacher, Sharon Salzberg. Oh, we've been friends forever.
Yeah. But,
and we have I'm going to tell you anyhow because. Well, before, let me preface what I want to say about Sharon and I in that sense. I did not have that role model that you just described from your mother and grandfather. My mother's mother, to some degree, loved me, and there was a lot of love, but it wasn't that. And she wasn't living with us, and I wasn't there day to day. And so I acted out, as I said, I'm embarrassed to even go on about how I really acted out. And that continued until, you're pointing it. Okay.
Me too.
I'm worse. No. I'm bad. You're good. So what happened, and this was what happens with many, many people, you then spend the rest of your life moving back. And, you know, God willing, you do find there is a path to transform. And you are not your mind and your thoughts and your story and your emotions. You do find that. And then you sort of have to spend quite a bit of time. Okay, I've been at this decades, unraveling that stuff. Mm-hmm. What you were not given, where you were not held and nurtured, and kindness and compassion were not involved. It was more in my mother's case. Unfortunately, she had manic depression, and so she was involved with fear. And that went back to her father, who passed way before she became an adult. And so we spend all of this time spinning into this unraveling, which, or we do what I described earlier, we get into spiritual life and we just absolutely exchange that ego and just use it to bypass. There's one thing in the book, you know, I'm going to bring this up, and this is part therapy. This is my therapy. Mm-hmm. So there's one part in the book where you quote, you quote Pema Chodron. Mm. I love Pema. Who doesn't love Pema Chodron? She's so phenomenal, right? Anybody who doesn't know, we'll put some links in the show notes so you can pick up her books. But extraordinarily practical. Her teacher was Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, which some people have a problem with, and that's a whole other story. But he was the finest, in my mind, translator of Tibetan Buddhist wisdom in the West by far. Mm-hmm. I mean, now there are many others that do justice, including His Holiness, but Trungpa was really special. I mean, really special. Anyhow, so Pema comes from that tradition. She said, this is the quote, "We already have everything we need." Absolutely true. But I find it to be that kind of thing can tend to be in people an up level, and that you do not deal with the guts of what you need to deal with because you perhaps did not have that mother that you had Amanda.
Yeah.
And so that I've always, part of what I do here on this podcast is trying to bring all this into a realistic isn't the right word, but grounded way in which we can relate with these teachings to affect us on a day-to-day basis without getting ourselves into an intellectual tied up kind of situation where you're thinking yourself through and you are not relating with the experiential part, which is why meditation and that practice and mindfulness is, of course, extraordinarily helpful. So back to Sharon. So Sharon is our preeminent metta loving kindness teacher in this country, brought it back with Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein. I mean, she's the part of that triumvirate that is her. It's like if you meet Sharon, it's there. You always feel, okay, I'm going to be okay. Just hang out with Sharon for a while. So, you know, I've done tons of stuff with her just for that reason. I don't care about that. And I just care about, gee, I just want to hang out with that metta. So I would, you know, I haven't been there in some time, but in terms of the retreats that she's led back east in Massachusetts, she does a lot of loving kindness retreats. And and she'd say, do you want to come? And I'd say, Sharon, I don't like loving kindness meditation at all. I want to do straight Vipassana and blah, blah, blah. And we'd laugh because to this day, she says, oh, I'm going to do, like we'd be somewhere teaching, she'd be teaching, I'd be with her teaching, whatever. And she'd say, okay, now we're going to do a loving kindness meditation. And she'd look at me, you can do something else, okay? So it's, what is it about? It's about, I get, you know, it comes from my trauma of early trauma and causes and conditions, which I don't want to be ahead of myself. Mind-wise, intellectually. I got to experience it truly and authentically, and I thank God. And that's why people say, well, you went over and you were with this enlightened being in India, and you're lucky. No, I'm not lucky. I needed to be hit over the head with a sledgehammer because I was so you-know-what up. So that is a big thing for me, and I try and talk about that with whoever it is that will listen to me, and you just listen to me. Thank you.
I'm so glad that you're bringing this in because as you already know, Raghu, you're not alone with that initial feeling of, I don't know if I like loving kindness meditation, or what is this all about, this loving kindness meditation of wishing myself aspirations and wishes of happiness and health and safety and well-being and joy and ease. And I, too, when my practice really landed in mindfulness-based meditation practices and then insight meditation, Vipassana, and then Buddhist-inspired practice, I had that same initial path where I was so good with basic mindfulness practice. It was so helpful to me. It was very supportive to me in a sense, but it was also very intriguing. It was very insightful. I was so enamored with the richness of basic mindfulness practice, basic mindfulness of body, of trying to focus my mind upon the breath, mindfulness of thinking, mindfulness of emotions. I very quickly realized that I had very low emotional maturity as an adult or a young person. And for many years, a lot of my practice edge was really growing my own self-awareness around being honest with my emotions and getting to know what my emotional landscape was beyond, oh, I'm good, or, oh, no, I'm fine, I'm not so great. That was really just where I was teetering between for, you know, all of my life prior. And so basic mindfulness was very, very helpful, very insightful. And when I was first exposed to loving kindness meditation by Jack Kornfield, I was at one of his Monday night sitting groups. at Spirit Rock, his meditation center up in Marin County. And we were in, well into a sit, maybe a 20 or 30 minute sit. And then all of a sudden he started offering loving kindness instructions after a period of mindfulness in, sitting and mindfulness instruction. And as I was listening to, of course, Jack's embodiment of these phrases, to your point, these this warm-hearted, open, inviting, just full of kindness, these instructions on start to wish yourself the following phrases and aspirations. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I be safe and protected. May I live with ease. And there was something in that moment where it felt so awkward and alien to be repeating these words towards myself and like even potentially trying to receive these sorts of wishes from my very own heart and mind. And in that very same moment, I could tell after I kind of got over that initial, like, what is this? This is weird. Do I like this? Do I not like this? I could sense in my own mind, body, heart, I was like, there's something undeniably helpful here. And there's something undeniably medicinal and true for me here too. And it was in that first real contact with loving kindness meditation where I began to open up to more of the heart practices, more of how do it, in a sense, it was like, how do I not only meet myself with awareness, with my mindfulness, how do I not only become self-aware, but how do I meet what it is I become aware of with skillfulness and with any sort of compassionate understanding so I can actually start to transmute and transform, but really make whatever it is I was becoming aware of more workable in my practice as well.
Yeah. I think a key word here is compassion, because there's no way to embody compassion without developing heart practice. And what I love, Ram Dass in the latter part of his life in Maui came up with the term loving awareness, right? And he used to have so much fun with Jack and Sharon and Joseph and so on, because it talk about, Ram Dass did nothing but talk about souls all the time, soul land, you know. And he'd look at them askance and, you know, no soul, I understand. But and then they would laugh at him. You know, it was such a, because there is only one thing. It's being described very differently in different traditions, but there is no possibility of there being more than one. There's only one, which that's what we got from Maharaj Neem Karoli Baba. It says you sat down. Sub ek, it's all one. There is only one, you know. I think that I'm really kind of happy that we, in the tradition we come from, somehow he led us into Buddhism by virtue of insight meditation. He never told one person to go there. Somehow we started going there. And then in English he'd go, oh, going to the course. And he, in English, he'd use the word course, which he supposedly couldn't speak English. And we go, yeah. And then I remember one time I went to the course and I came back and he was with some Indian people. And I got to the place where he was. We had just been at the course. It must have been four or five of us. And he said, oh, you know how to meditate now? And yeah. And he said, okay, go ahead. So we all sat up and started meditating. Within 10 seconds, there was this high-peeled laughter, and he was going, this is through the translator, oh, you're good meditators, he said. You're really good, you know. That's how we got into it. I mean, we're talking about, you know, from Ram Dass down, Danny Goleman, who is close to His Holiness, and, you know, go on and on with different people who have gone out in the world and done quite wonderful things. And but somehow that was a reality. And in that reality, combined with the heart stuff, meaning bhakti yoga, basically, that is, I find, and we've been doing it all these years before with Ram Dass until he left a couple of years ago, with all of our Buddhist brethren, And the combination of it, has, to me, it's absolutely necessary, I think. And that's why His Holiness's statement, if the compassion that your mother could share with you or envelop you in, and kindness, that will go further than anything else to help us transform this these very difficult times and the polarization. So that's, you know, again, and that's what attracted me to your book. And boy, there's so much of that going on now. People are talking about it. I mean, I have to believe that you're being asked to speak about this in different venues.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, it and even from, if we take it from even the pure mindfulness perspective, in a sense, taking a step back, looking at the field of secular or modern contemporary mindfulness as we know it here in the West, the past many decades, we've been centered on this conversation of basic mindfulness and growing our self-awareness. Even the commoditization of mindfulness around how do we become a better, more productive version of ourselves, or how do we optimize our health and our happiness and our well-being in our lives. And as a modern day practitioner, and then as somebody who has the privilege to hold space for these practices and to be in the teacher seat, I've started to really, really recognize that I was getting the same question over and over again, which was, you know, Amanda, now that I've learned how to meditate, I understand what I'm supposed to be doing from a mindfulness perspective. I bring my attention back to the present moment, but now what? You know, what is there next? Like, what do I do with all this stuff that I'm becoming aware of? And so I started to hear that question over and over again, and then just even taking a step back to what it is we've been, of course, going through the last 19 to 24 months, but even beforehand, I just felt like the truth around where we can be going in the field of mindfulness is we have to start coming back to the heart. We have to start bringing in kindness and compassion. These practices, the other wing of the mindfulness meditation bird, so to speak, or the wing of Buddhist practice, there's the wing of awareness, and then there's the wing of compassion. We have to start talking about the heart practices more. If anything, I think it's the call of our time to really step into the practices in the wing and the home of the heart.
Yeah, I'm with you all the way, Amanda. Absolutely. But in the beginning of your book, though, it does state, I mean, all of us who, again, find the path, find there is a path, and hopefully you meet people like Amanda's grandfather, who would just walk into a room and you would feel embraced. Mm-hmm. It's what happened to me. I met Ram Dass the first time. I felt embraced completely and unconditionally. He stepped out of the way. Richard and Ram Dass, they were not there. There was just embracement from a heart place that was something I had never really experienced. You know, I give the caveat, which is, I guess, I can't really remember, but my mother, when I was an infant, you know, mothers do, no matter what, in this case, somebody who was challenged emotionally, but still, you have no choice. For the most part. But I didn't really remember that. And so certainly you had your grandfather. It took me to meet up with Ram Dass before that happened. But the reality is that everyone has an opportunity that if you're open to it. So what does that mean? I'm not satisfied with what is going on in my life. I am constantly in turmoil. Constantly unhappy. So then I want to change. Just that. I want to change. And so this is what in the beginning of the book, it's all about intention. And if one has, so where do you get intention from, right? From real unhappiness with what is going on in your life. and suddenly I want to change. That's the first intention. And then just two paragraphs later in your book, it's you talk about wise view. And certainly, the first thing is to realize where you are seeing everything from, your life, the world, people around you. Where are you seeing that from? What is that perspective? And for 99.9, it's here, you know, in our heads, believing, we're thinking, and we have a story, and we believe it all. I mean, I tell this story a lot. Adi Ashanti, do you know who Adi Ashanti is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Just talking to him, and he was like, he couldn't believe when he was a kid that what these adults all around him were acting out in the most screwed up ways, you know, yelling and this and drinking, whatever they were doing. And then it took him to when he was like 10 or 11, where he had this realization. I know what it is, he said. They believe their thoughts. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. And then he went into meditation and, you know, I mean, when he was very young, I mean, just as he was a teenager and for years and years and years. And it took him to, he got to the point where he finally had to let go because there was a purpose involved. And meditation and purpose, that's like the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita. Yeah, looking for results is not exactly what's going to be optimum for you. Hmm. But doing it because you want to get to know yourself better. And so everybody has that opportunity one way or the other, if you get this intention, right or wrong, where a teacher will come, a book will come, a grandpa will come, somebody or something will come. It will, the answer will, it, the call will be there and the response will be there as well.
Absolutely. I believe the first title of chapter one in Kindness Now is a call from the heart, which is exactly what you're describing so beautifully and elegantly, Raghu, is the precious opportunity that we have as human beings to open up to the call, to then have the privilege to recognize the call, and then the courage and perhaps the resources, the teacher, the book, the timing, et cetera, to answer that call from our heart or that call from our own true nature, our own home of loving awareness within. And I love that you are bringing that in. I agree with you that if we are open to it or have that view, to your point, then we are able to come into contact with that warm embrace or that opportunity to really step into our own hearts.
Yeah, universe will speak. Absolutely. I mean, in our tradition, we call that universe a guru. Mm-hmm. And there's so many different ways you can contextualize what that is. It's, you know, I mean, now there's, oh yeah, he's the dry cleaner guru is, yeah, he's the best dry cleaner, you know. So it's been like most of our terminology, the weight of it has gone away by virtue of the commonality of it. It's just love. And Sharon did a great thing one day. She's talking about love and she said, yeah, it's not a, you talk about love, people and kindness, they think you're weak, you know, and our concepts are so screwed up. It's unbelievable. So it's the, courage is involved here. Just with the kinds of terminology and how we use it, how we accept it, how we respond to it and so on. So I love this quote though. I know we got a couple of minutes. I know you got to go in a minute, but I have to because I never imagined this in a million years. Okay. In fact, I'd like to do a contest to say anybody could even take a guess as to who said this. Practice kindness all day to everybody, and you will realize you're already in heaven now. Jack Kerouac. I mean, that's... Mm-hmm. That's phenomenal. and And so may I meet this too with kindness. And I take that to mean the 10,000 beautiful visions and the 10,000 horrible visions. Mm-hmm. May I meet that too with kindness.
Yeah.
And this is not just a fun aphorism. This is a reality, and the reality behind it, in my mind, in my experience, is doing the practice that's necessary to be able to meet everything and everyone with kindness. And it can't be an intellectual concept that we say words about but are not doing the inner work that's necessary to embody what we're talking about. That's been a little bit of a theme here in this chat mm-hmm. that we're having. And I think the most important thing is that when a bit of that can happen and you can embody it, then we can become like your grandpa, where he walks into a room and everybody is being radiated. Ram Dass used to talk about this. Clean up your heart and move into the center of your chest, into the spiritual home, soul, spirit, no mind, whatever you want to call it, and then go out and radiate that to whoever. And that goes all the way to social action and social justice and everything that you would want to do to effect change. And last thing is just to say, of course, you can't say to yourself, well, I'm going to grow into that, then I'll see what I can do to help. It's all happening at the same time, which is the beauty of this book that you wrote. It includes all of the whole package, and not just, I just want to be kind to people. When His Holiness says, kindness is my only religion, that's where we should take the totality of the meaning of that word.
And I appreciate that you're pointing us here, because it gives us the golden opportunity to even dismantle our own current views of what being kind means. Can we allow kindness to be synonymous with being brave, being courageous, being outspoken, being in alignment with the sorts of values and sort of change that we want to see in the world? Being kind does not mean rolling over into passivity. It doesn't necessarily mean niceness or being a doormat. Being kind is sometimes the hardest thing that we are being called to do, especially in the face of even our close inner circle triggers, like our close family members, our close friends. Yeah. Even our most immediate world, to be kind to these humans who we're in karmic contracts with, that know what our exact buttons to push are, to know what our triggers are, et cetera. to understand that kindness can mean so much more than we usually think about it. I feel like, to your point and to Jack Kerouac's point, it really can make it possible more heaven-like experience for all of us on earth, but a heaven that is grounded in the realness of what's actually happening right now, a heaven that is grounded in true compassion and change.
Yeah, absolutely. And the one that just pops into my head that Neem Karoli Baba used to say, or I said a few times, never throw anyone out of your heart. Never throw anyone out of your heart. And that doesn't mean you got to like everybody. But it does mean you can't do what we are so proficiently doing now these days in every way. The polarity in our culture, in our country, and in the world is so tremendously difficult, and we are throwing people out of our hearts. I mean, I see my own tendencies, you know, related to what the incoming stuff of from politics to, gee, are you vaxxed? It's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And talk about, yeah, close people that we're interacting with, because, you know, we're okay, we're all part of the liberal family or whatever that may be. And then, but now we're going to create a tribal thing between us,
right,
around vaccination, you know.
Right.
So the kindness is taking all of that, you know, and of course reflecting it. But start with yourself, right, which you talk about in the book.
Yeah.
So yeah. Great to meet you.
Same, Raghu. This has been the most delightful time to reconnect, re-meet each other, re-familiarize ourselves with each other, and to be a part of this really, really meaningful conversation. I'm honored to be here and to be spending time together.
Oh, it's been great, great. It's just another notch in the friendship window that I have. Another window, you know, it's like all these panes, and I have all these people in my mind's eye that I'm now connected to. It's like grace, really is, really is. By the way, you will find everything in the show notes, and you'll be able to connect with the book, obviously, and link it up and get it, and as well Amanda and what she represents and what she's done, websites and all that. And we didn't hardly get anywhere to. I mean, there's so much that we could have talked about. Maybe we got to do something again in the future, near future.
I already can't wait for any part two in whatever iteration that may take, Raghu. Absolutely.
Thank you. This is Mind Rolling. And thank you, Amanda, again. And go to BeHereNowNetwork.com. And we have a whole plethora of some of the people we've been talking about, from Sharon to Jack and Joseph and much, much, much more. And of course, Ram Dass. We will see you next week.